Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation features Brendan Colley. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. These are unceded lands, and treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Brendan Colley is a Hobart-based writer. He won the University of Tasmania Prize for an unpublished work in 2019, and he joins me today with his debut novel, The Signal Line. Gio has returned to Tasmania following the death of his father to sell the family home. This triggers a reunion with his brother Wes, who has followed in their father's footsteps, stayed in Tassie, became a cop. Wes is not having any of Gio's talk about selling. The house contains too many memories. Gio needs money to fund his auditions and fulfill his dream of joining a symphony orchestra. That dream is Gio's true north, a journey that has taken him far from Tasmania. Gio's arrival sets the stage for an untimely family conflict, one of supernatural proportions. Join me as we discover Brendan Colley's The Signal Line. That was an absolutely seamless transition.
Perfect.
Thanks for taking the time with that. And I'm going to start by complimenting your background. So many writers have their bookshelves up, but I kind of love the posters.
Yeah, no, I prefer that sort of energy going on in my writing space.
Amazing. Oh, terrific. And this is, I was actually double checking because we weren't linking up straight away. I thought, I'm going to double check time difference. I'm pretty sure you're in Hobart. I'm pretty sure it's, and I accidentally went to my weather app, and I know that you're calling in from a fairly cool space, just like myself at the moment.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, there's only about a dozen days a year where I don't need a heater or a fan. It's one of the two. You know, the natural climate just doesn't work.
yes, indeed. Yeah, it feels like it's been winter for a couple of months already, but it's kind of nice. I like it. And very, very atmospheric for us both. Now, oh, The Signal Line, mate. I'm really excited to talk this through. My name is Andrew Popel, and today I get to introduce you to one of, I'm going to confidently say we're only halfway through the year, but it's been one of my favourite reads so far. It's a new book from Brendan Colley. Brendan is a Hobart-based writer. He won the University of Tasmania Prize for an unpublished work in 2019. It's published now. The Signal Line, it's his first novel. Brendan, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much. Good to be here, Andrew.
And I did get that correct, right? The unpublished work has now become The Signal Line.
That's right. So this sat in manuscript format for a couple of years after luckily winning the University of Tasmania Prize, and it is now a book in the world.
We all look, and those years were 2020, 2021. We all sat in manuscript format, I think, in our homes at that time. So it's great to see it released into the world with the rest of us. I want to introduce the book, and I'm really interested in your take on my introduction. Gio has returned to Tasmania following the death of his father to sell the family home. His brother Wes followed in their father's footsteps, becoming a cop, and he's not having any of Gio's talk about selling. Gio needs the money to fund his auditions and fulfill his dream of joining a symphony orchestra. Wes needs a home and the link to the memories of their beloved but emotionally unavailable father. Gio's arrival sets the stage for an ultimate family conflict. And then a ghost train appears. And Brendan, look, I feel like I've kind of diverged a little from the formula introducing The Signal Line. I mean, the ghost train, it's a pretty compelling hook. But like, for me though, like what was truly compelling about the book was the relationship between Wes and Gio. So now I'm going to flip it back. I want to ask you to introduce these two as you know them and tell us a little bit about why they fascinated you.
Thank you. And it's interesting though, because with this story, the first thing that arrived to me was the ghost train. And I had read an article along the way. I was working on another project at the time, and it was about ghost trains in Eurasia. And it so captivated me that I put aside my project just for a couple of sessions. And I really quickly came up with this arc of a ghost train that had arrived in Hobart and was starting to make appearances around, you know, on the old tramway lines and decommissioned railway lines across Tasmania. But I didn't know who the story belonged to, and it wasn't really important to me. I like to collect bits and pieces, and then, you know, when I'm looking for a new project, I'll try different things on. So I put it aside, and it was only a year later that I thought there was a question that I wanted to explore, and that's what led me to Geo and Wes. And at that time, I had been writing for 19 years, unpublished, and I had just finished a manuscript which had taken me 6.5 years to write, and it was roundly rejected. And for the first time, I was starting to question my dream, like putting all of this time into writing, and was it okay to be just writing for myself? And I thought, if I could find a character who was questioning their own dream, and that was Geo, who's an aspiring violist, he's 30 years old, and he has the talent to justify having that dream, but he perhaps doesn't have the talent to realize it. I thought, if I could put that together with this ghost train, because there's nothing more certain of its direction than a train on a track. And there's nothing more elusive than something so solid that's able to sort of slip its path. And I thought that there was something there that might reflect my character's own questions about his direction that could work as a sort of a metaphor or a motif for his journey. And then once I found that connection, then it sort of led to the antagonistic character in Wes and the greater cast of characters.
I can absolutely see the through line here, or perhaps we'll call it the signal line. We're going to discuss that more in a minute. But that dynamic of Wes and Geo is absolutely just electrifying. I would have happily read these two characters bouncing off each other, or maybe more sort of tackling off each other. And it got me thinking a little bit about how it can feel like we don't talk enough or even have a chance as men to discuss our intimate relationships. We see sort of male protagonists are often solo. Do you feel like it has come to the point where we literally need paranormal intervention to get men to sort through their emotions?
It's, you know, that's such an interesting question. I know that in my own life, I have a small number of very close friendships with men, and I find for me they tend to be quite intimate. We're quite close. We talk about everything. But I think that's more something that's recent. I think when I was in my 20s and my 30s, you didn't have those types of conversations. I don't know what's changed. I know. In that time, I know for my characters, in its initial version, I didn't have them living in the same space. I had Wes living in his house, Geo living somewhere else. But the tension between them didn't seem fraught enough, and it became very clear to me early that if I could have a reason for them being forced to live in one space while they sort through their differences, that would offer greater possibilities in terms of how they speak to one another. And then the interesting thing is that Geo's way of dealing with it is to latch on to these quirky people that cross his path and bring them into that space to be a sort of a buffer and neutralize Wes, who's quite threatening and intimidating as a personality.
I'm really interested in quite a few things you've said there. I guess particularly you mentioned that you have these relationships in your life now, but you feel like it's a more recent thing. And I think a lot of men might feel that way. And I wonder if something about the historical moment we're in, where we have watched women fighting and fighting back against, I guess, patriarchal power, but also the way that plays out in their lives, if it hasn't perhaps also given men an opportunity to examine their own lives and realize that, we have been at times complicit in silence. And as soon as you find your voice, you actually find this desire to use it and become more who you are, which is really something that Gio goes through as well. There are numerous times in the book where Gio finds himself being different versions of himself and thinking that's very un-Gio, but he likes what it brings to him. Did you always conceive that Gio was going to go through that evolution, or did that happen with the story?
Yes, I think, and this is, I would say, true for most projects, long projects, where it probably takes a good 3 or 4 drafts to sort of find out the essence of who your characters are. When I started with Gio, as I do with any novel that I'm working with, I have an idea of something specific that I'm going after, but really their nature really starts to reveal themselves, their true selves, to me as the writer, as I go through that drafting period. But I think Gio is definitely at a point in his life where he is asking more questions than he has answers for. And I didn't necessarily want him to get to a place where he had the answers for those questions or knew himself better, but rather that he could accept where he is and that he could be more relaxed in where he is and who he is without knowing really where he might get to.
Again, you are amazingly introducing ideas that I want to talk about, but I ignored your comment before about the incredible ensemble cast of characters, and I want to come back to that. But first, acknowledging that, again, it feels like we should be talking all things Ghost Train. What a hook. But I think that I think that the Spectral Locomotive, its presence is, for me, it was this unique opportunity for you to introduce us to Sten, the man who has been hunting the train for 40 years. When you're writing a man like Sten in the now, Sten very much exists in Hobart. The book is set in 2018, I think I'm correct in saying. How much do you have to actually understand to write Sten over a few weeks in 2018, his 40-year odyssey?
The way that I came at Sten was really through how he could reflect Gio. And so Sten, really when Sten first arrived on the page for me, he was just extremely fun to write because, like, can a person like this possibly exist? A 60-year-old man who's been chasing a ghost train for 40 years, whose only mission in life is to intercept something that that to everyone else would say doesn't even exist. Mm. And yet he's completely calm about this. And so that's just a fun starting point. What really activated Sten for me is when I realized that he could work really as a reflection to Gio. Here we have someone 30 years old who is chasing something that feels within reach. Like if he just does or makes 1 or 2 adjustments, this is something he can clearly get. And alongside him is this ghost train hunter who is completely at peace pursuing something that for all intents and purposes is unattainable. And I thought that was an excellent reflection to Gio's angst at something that he has as a goal that he wants now and can't live with having now. And then when I understood that, I could then more write towards the essence of who Sten is. And again, I think with each draft and with each passing year, you're able to really work on the layers of who that person is. And the more that they speak and the more that you spend time with them, the more you can sort of like find the words that you know are theirs rather than yours as the creator.
I loved what you said about, you know, the idea that could Sten possibly exist, because like without fail, as I read him in the Signal line, Stellan Skarsgård was in my head. Like it was so visually real. And I mean, if I was just fan casting this, you could create an amazing series where Stellan Skarsgård plays Sten, and then you've got, take your pick of the younger Skarsgårds to do flashbacks. It's just so real.
That's a great thought. Out of all the characters I've had, and I forget what the suggestions have been, but a couple of people who've read the book have suggested characters for Sten, but no one else. They're the one who they have a character in mind for. And it's kind of interesting. He's such an odd and interesting character to me, at least.
As you're talking, I'm like, no, actually, I think I could fan cast the entire book for you. But I mean, that's going to be a little bit fraught. Just throwing it out there, the brothers from Supernatural, the two actors, I'm forgetting their names, but there's Wes and Gio. As Gio, Wes and Sten are thrown together, they're sleeping in the living room of the house that Wes has, you know, he's reduced to this sort of shrine to their father. We start to learn a little bit of the passions that have shaped their lives. And Sten.
That's perfect.
Sten describes this idea of the passion and his passion as the signal line. It's his signal line. What can you tell me a little bit about this concept and how that consuming passion can shape a life?
It's interesting because probably for the first year and a half of writing this novel, I didn't have a title, and which was a first for me, because usually, you know, in the moments that I come up with an idea, you know, I often have the title, and the title really is sort of like a beacon that you sort of is a resonating force for the novel. And it was really worrying me that I had this strong feeling for this the story that I was writing, but I didn't have a label for it. And at the time, I was interested in listening to podcasts and you know, of odd nature, and I listened to this remote viewer talking about their remote viewing technique and their protocols. Remote viewing is a person, whether or not you believe that this is actually something you can have a capability to do, but they're able to sit in one place and then view or see something that is where they are not. And there are certain protocols that you go through to do this. And as they describe it, they receive little bits and pieces or little visuals, and they sort of chasing these visuals. And as long as you can keep track on these visuals, you are then on the signal line. And if you lose track, you have to start again. And that phrase, the signal line, I thought captured really the essence of the story and the many different parts. I mean, it has the feeling of sort of railway track sort of like hinting off of it. It sort of also reflects, I think, that idea of sort of chasing something and knowing when you are sort of on a clear path towards it. And even now, my wife and I, when we speak and we talk about, we talk in general conversation about anything, you know, we'll say, oh, I'm not on the signal line with this. It just seems to be this catchphrase that is able to reflect the idea of sort of being in a zone or in a mindset or in the place that you need to be with anything. And my characters are all at the crossroads of their own respective journeys and all trying to stay on the signal line of their own, you know, paths. So that's quite a long-winded way of trying to address that question, but I'm very happy with the title now, but it took a long time to sort of come my way.
And it lends itself as well to the extraordinary cover. So let's do that thing that is so amazing for radio and talk about book covers, because the signal line has this incredible visual feast. It's an embossed cover, and it has kind of the railway signal in the fluorescent yellow against a black background, and it just pops. It also has a real kind of topographical feel, and I want to try and maybe more neatly segue us into something you were talking about there, the signal line, and you now I have forgotten the name of the process, but Sten, he does this in his work. He's taken by visions, and this idea of place kind of seems to sear itself on him. He is able to sketch out these places, and then they become locations in his memory. And it builds into this almost kind of a history of rail through Sten, but also for Geo, as he has returned home, I got a sense the signal line, the book, has become a bit of an homage to spaces around Hobart. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about space and place. Like, what role does geography, and yes, I do hear it as I say it, what role does geography play in your storytelling?
Yeah, it's curious because as I think I mentioned before, I've now been writing for 25 years seriously and routinely, and everything that I worked on before this novel, and first I should add, I'm sure people can pick up from my accent, but I come from South Africa, and I left South Africa after university, and I was on the road for 11 years. I lived in the UK. I lived in Japan. I met my wife, Australian, in Japan. We settled down in Australia about 14 years ago. But as a result of sort of this nomadic existence of moving and relocating and sort of living on the road, everything that I wrote, I set in a fictional place, just a nondescript town, because I didn't feel that I was connected. I felt like I loved wherever I lived, but I wasn't connected to the place that I was living at, and I just sort of made this unconscious choice to not set my stories in the place that I was living. And it's only after we settled down in Hobart, which was 12 years ago, that I really started to feel connected to the place in which I was living, and had the confidence then to set a story here. And I think that's one of the things I'm most like happy with the book, is that it's sort of a tribute to the town that has given me, you know, my new home.
I'm so interested though, because in thinking on my reading of Geo's returned to Hobart, there is a big theme through the book about whether it is home, or he talks right at the beginning about it being a place that he had left forever, and he's very uneasy about returning. But I also, I feel listening to you there that maybe through Sten, you're coming to peace with that nomadic lifestyle that you had. And I was really, I was really taken by the way Sten evokes place and space through the appearances of, he calls it his train. And he very much seems like someone, as you described yourself, who wasn't connected to places that he was only in for a very short period of time. It was very transitory. But it seems like his moment in that place has seared something on his story, at least.
Yes, it's. I mean, I think this would be true for most writers, that these different parts of you sort of feed their way. You know, a novel is a novel. It's not really a memoir. But I think if you're writing from a true place, you know, you're able to sort of reflect different aspects of yourself in a very unconscious way through these characters. They become vehicles for your own journey, your own scars, you know, and I know, like, I come from a very loving family. And it's difficult because my father's passed away. I've got one brother, and here I've written about two brothers. And you know, I give the story to my mother to read, and I can't trust her to not read this as a literal representation of our family, which it absolutely is not. But the one thing that is that, you know, my parents divorced when I was 5 years old. We've always been estranged by geography. And a lot of the stories that I have are people either leaving home or returning home or questioning what home is. And a lot of my, particularly my protagonists, seem to be, in transition, you know, in terms of their physical place. They seem to be passing through a place or fighting the place they're in. And that's probably more an echo of my own journey. It's not something that I wanted to explore. It's something that I sort of turn around and go, oh, it's that theme again. You know, you can't get away from, I suppose, who you are.
Mm. Everyone listening right now wants me to ask if your brother's read this.
He has a coffee. I sent him and my mother a copy. He hasn't read it yet. He's in London. Mm. I spoke to my mother last week, actually, and then she didn't know if he was going to read it. He's going to read it because he supports me. He has no, you know, it's just he's not a reader. And then she started telling him about the story, and he was like, no, don't tell me anything. I want to read it. So he'll get around to reading it.
You've put him in a double bind here, because if he reads it and he thinks you've written him as Wes, he actually can't react too much, because then he's kind of fulfilling the Wes role.
Well, he's the younger brother and Wes is the older brother. So potentially he's the hero.
Oh, lovely. Well, there you go. Again, you've written him into a corner. He just has to be the supportive brother. So about now, with radio, we could conceivably take a music break, but I want to take a break to talk music, because in the signal line, we have from Wes and Gio's family legacy, which I might get you to explain a bit, to the irrepressible Paco's flamenco guitar licks. The signal line is full of music. What did you want the reader to understand about the role music plays in our lives?
At first, it was just a choice where I needed a talent for my character, because they were questioning it, and it took me a long time to really settle upon Gio as an aspiring musician, and I didn't understand what music could offer the story when I came up with the idea of being a violist. When I decided or felt that that was the organic fit, is that Gio was going to be a musician. It was immediately apparent to me, for no reason, that it was a classical musician. And then it was a question of being pragmatic, and, you know, it couldn't have been a bassoon. So it felt, I settled upon a violin. But then the more I spent time with Gio and his family history, as you say, so his father, in fact, was an extremely talented violinist, but gave it away young, and so was Wes, who gave it away young. And the mother was a viola teacher, and Gio took up the viola. The choice of viola compared to violin was because the viola is sometimes considered the poor cousin, of those two, of the violin. And I thought that it made sense that someone who's questioning their talent would be playing the viola rather than the violin. But it was the visual that first attracted me, the idea of Gio keeping Sten company as he stakes out his train on abandoned platforms, train platforms, around Greater Hobart, Southern Tasmania, with a viola to his chin and sort of weaving a tune. It was as simple as that, that sort of excited me. And then, you know, Paco, who comes into the story about a third of the way through, that character was based on, and his partner Camille, they're two hippie backpackers who end up spending time, with Gio and in the house. They were actually based on real people. I picked up this young couple, gave them a ride just outside of Hobart. I was living in near Signet at the time, and during the summer, backpackers come out to Tasmania for the fruit picking season. Gave them a ride, ended up becoming really good friends with these two young travelers who were leading a nomadic existence that reminded me of the one that I was leading. And he had a guitar and took it wherever he went. And so I actually asked those two friends of mine to name those two characters that inspired me in the story. And they actually came up with the names Paco and Camille and named their own characters. So again, it wasn't like I was going after music. It's because, you know, that person was carrying a guitar. So Paco was carrying a guitar. And then I went after it. Because now that it was there, it seemed to just add this acoustic soundtrack to the story I was telling, and then I just doubled down and went after it as hard as I could, and it just added another sort of effect to the story that really helped in its tone. And it's just a crazy mix of ideas that I didn't know if it would work. And I think maybe I pulled it off, but that's one element that fits in there and seems to have its place.
If it doesn't already exist, throw together a playlist for this, because this is it would be extraordinary. Like, you can hear, I could hear music as I read the book, and it really complements the story. I'd like to pick up a thread there that you mentioned, Wes's talent, and also by virtue of their father's talent, because it's really a very singular moment. It's almost a throwaway line where we learn about their father's talent, whereas very much the image we have of him is someone who has problems with pain, problems with alcohol, problems with where their life has turned out. But Wes and his father kind of epitomize, I'm going to call it the peaked in high school effect. But because of this extraordinary talent, and because Gio perceives that he doesn't have the same natural talent, their talent has kind of become deified, whereas in other aspects of our life, you know, the peaked in high school is almost a little bit of a sad trope. How do you feel about that, I guess, juxtaposition, the idea that maybe you made it once and you can always point to that achievement versus the idea that the chase is what matters and that you are always moving, and if you stop moving, that's the end?
I mean, it's probably worth sharing because it helps to fully explain the you know, my motivation for writing the story, and you know, my fixation on this idea of talent and dream and questioning things. As I said, I started writing when I was in my early 20s, but the reason why I started writing was because to replace another dream. So growing up, I wanted to be a professional soccer player. And like Gio, I had the talent to sort of justify that dream. I played representative, got a scholarship, you know, to university, but I wasn't good enough to make it. And I knew that as soon as I finished university, I was going to stop playing soccer cold. There was no way that I could go and play that sport just socially for the enjoyment. It had been so important as being part of my life, as something that I was chasing. But I now knew that there was going to be this incredible vacuum left in my life, this time. And what was I going to do with that time? And I don't know where this came from, but I just knew that I loved having a dream and having something to wake up for, to make sacrifices for, to suffer for, to aspire towards. And the only other thing in my life that I was passionate about was writing. At the time, I was writing lyrics with a pianist. We sort of had these crazy ambitions of being the next Bernie Taupin and Elton John, which maybe explains my interest in music. And so I thought, okay, well, let me see if I can write something on my own. So, you know, that first summer after stopping soccer, I wrote a book of short stories. Then I wrote a play. I wrote another play. And then I started writing a screenplay, and that was it. I was like, this is it. This is what I'm now going to do. 15, 20 hours a week on top of my job. And the best thing about it is if I'm not good enough, no one can take it away from me. I can write until the day I die. Unlike, say, soccer, which has a shelf life, where if you haven't made it by a certain age, you're not going to make it. And so it was interesting because I've seen people who didn't make it who were more talented than me. And then you see people who make it because they just persist long enough. And so it was interesting to me to have Gio here, who has the desire, the will, the ambition, the single-mindedness, the prepared to sacrifice, if sitting opposite him is a brother who had all the talent if he had only gone after it. It was definitely something that had to feature in some way in the story. And then that's also why Paco and Camille were useful, because I really felt like I needed a presence there of two people who cared not more than the moment they were in or the next thing. So they provided this sort of counter to these characters who had given up or who were chasing something. Mm. Here were two people who were just happy to be where they were. So,
at the risk of sounding glib, how are your knees? Because as someone, I never had talent, but as someone who didn't stop playing soccer, I feel like if I had given it up in my early 20s, there'd be a few mornings I'd wake up feeling a little less sore.
You know, it's funny you say that. I have no cartilage in my left knee. I can't even go for a jog. And now, being the age that I'm at, I would love nothing more to go and play soccer once a week or go for a run. So, yeah, there was a price to pay there.
Yeah, look, I mean, I was having this, weirdly, I was having this conversation earlier in the week. I honestly feel, I don't know what our listenership is like. I don't know if we're hitting the 30s and 40s male demographic, but men in their 30s and 40s who are still playing soccer are insane. I do not want them sliding at me, trying to tackle me for the ball. I wouldn't make it to 50.
There's nothing more dangerous than a badly timed tackle.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think it was badly timed. I want to pull on these brilliant threads you keep laying out for me in talking about sort of the professional geniuses, and we can just sort of keep borrowing from soccer here. It always surprises me when I hear, you know, like hardcore fans talking about favorite players, and, you know, I'll pick on Cristiano Ronaldo. You hear talk about, you know, best player in the world, Ronaldo, winning games. They wouldn't win without him. Like, there aren't 10 other people on the field. And to get into that idea of what it means to be together as a group, I want to pick on a seemingly innocuous moment on Elizabeth Street Mall in the Signal Line, not in line. Now, Gio is busking, and he sees the mayor of Orvieto. He is one of the original passengers spirited to Tasmania on the ghost train that we meet at the very beginning of the book. Now, as the mayor and Gio, they speak about Berlio. That's what Gio has just been playing. Giacomo, he comments that a work of genius is often the suggestion of someone else. And I really wondered here whether you were commenting on the necessity for people to come together in art. And can you tell me, like, have I pulled a moment that you'd completely forgotten about out of the book, or what was happening in this moment?
No, it was interesting. And firstly, to go back to the soccer analogy, one that is one of my favourites was Bob Paisley, the old Liverpool manager. I'm not a Liverpool fan, but during the 70s, when he talked about the makeup of a team, he was like, I need one violinist and 10 road sweepers. You don't want too many violinists, but you can't only have road sweepers. So you need that little bit of magic there amongst, you know, that. So it's sort of interesting how music featured in that sort of analogy too. But with Giacomo, I remember that. I know that line, obviously. And I remember coming up with it when I wrote that scene. I wanted to be a fairly fleeting scene. It also was useful because it helped to sort of complete that arc. I didn't want to completely abandon and forget the story of the displaced Italians, disoriented Italians. I wanted to keep them alive sort of in the background. And I wanted there to be one connection between Gio and Giacomo. And obviously the natural environment was Gio, you know, throughout the novel, he's always looking to sort of raise money because he needs to get materials to paint the house. So he's always down Elizabeth Street Mall trying to busk. And I thought that would be a great place for Giacomo to pass. And, the line came out of nowhere. And then the minute I had the line, I didn't know what it meant, and I didn't know what it was suggesting, but I really loved that he said that. I think sometimes when I write scenes, right, particularly in the early drafts, before you're almost trying, well, I am certainly, I'm trying to sort of write ahead of my own thoughts. So I see what I'm writing. So I touch type. If I have a scene, I'm like, okay, this is what I want to write. This is what's going to happen. I sort of lower my fingers to the keyboard. And much like Sten does, where he's sort of chasing visuals, I sort of wait for things to happen. And I sort of see them, and I stare into like a distance, and then I just type what I see and sort of just follow it. And then I get up to a point where I don't see or feel anything anymore. And then I just sort of use my creative imagination to sort of complete the scene. But I remember that scene and that conversation being something where it happened without control, and that line sort of dropped out. And greatness often the suggestion of others. I don't know what it means, but it seemed to sort of belong in the mind and the observation of Giacomo, and it's something that Gio needed to hear.
I just love the suggestion that the things that we perceive to be exceptional and that we put up on a pedestal as exceptional always exist in this tension with the things that are not exceptional, that are everyday. You know, the musician is not exceptional unless someone is there to hear them be exceptional. The Ronaldos of the world are not the Ronaldos of the world unless they have someone to pass them the ball, and also an opposition to consistently be routed. Like we must exist in this tension, and if we don't appreciate it, I think it can become a little bit toxic. I like the socialness of that line.
Yeah. And thank you. And I mean, that's the question I was asking myself, right? Like, what validates a story? So I'd written for 19 years. This is my third novel. I wrote screenplays before that, book of short stories. I wrote a memoir of my 2 years living in London. I wrote a libretto. So many things before that were written and not sort of read or viewed. And so stories that maybe didn't realize themselves. And it's an interesting thought. That's definitely something that I was thinking about. And for me personally, I had to change my reasons for writing about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, where, you know, if the only thing that's going to validate this is, say, being published, then there's probably better ways to spend my time. And for me, it really came down to there being a reward in the act of creating something. That there's great joy in someone reading something you've written and being entertained by it, or being moved by it, or being provoked to think differently by it. But there is also an equal and perhaps more value in the act of creating something, in writing a story, in whistling a tune. You don't have to be great to do that. The greatness of the art doesn't move the creator more because it's better. It moves whoever, anything that is art can move a person who creates that art if you let it. The one thing that I would add is that the best advice that I ever received, I only received recently, last year. I listen to podcasts by creatives, by writers. I love listening to people, artists, talking about process. And I listened to someone last year in a podcast, and they posed a question that really moved me in a profound way. And I wish someone had challenged me with this question when I was starting out 25 years ago. And this was it. This person was a British playwright. And while they were going through their formal training, studying theatre, their mentor, their tutor, challenged everyone in the class to answer the following question: do you want a writing career, or do you want a writing life? And if you think about that, the way you approach your art or your discipline will be very different compared to how you feel or want to be. And I realized that in the last 15 years, I wanted a writing life. And if that's true, and you accept that, well, then I've always had writing since the day I started. And similarly, Geo already has music. And there's a twist in the novel that I won't even speak in which direction it comes, but which sort of reinforces that idea that, you know, very often we already have the things we're searching for. But I don't know, it's just human nature to always want that little bit more or that something else that you don't have. And that's where I wanted to leave Geo, is with that understanding that it's good to have this dream, but it's also important to know that you already have music in your life.
That was extraordinary. Thank you so much for those insights, Brendan. Now, throughout our conversation, as it is woven throughout the signal line, there is this ghost train that we really haven't kind of, we haven't stared directly at it, which, I mean, I don't recommend staring directly at approaching trains. I'm not gonna let you go without us talking about the supernatural, though. And one of your characters, I can't recall who right now. I think it might have been Stan. But, maybe Labuschagne. He talks about not believing in the supernatural so much as believing in the people who believe in it. What does belief mean to you? You don't have to talk directly to the train or any of the mysteries of the book, but I'm interested in this idea about belief.
Mm. It's my own sort of journey with belief. Everyone's journey with belief is a deeply personal one, or non-belief. I think it's worth sharing here. So, you know, I was brought up in a very strict evangelical Pentecostal household. You know, we prayed every night before we went to bed, youth group on a Friday night. I went to church 3 times on a Sunday. You know, speaking about things like God and angels as if, you know, they're just a matter of fact around you. And so I've obviously, well, not obviously, but I have gone on a journey that's trailed away from that. But possibly because of that, I still sort of believe in things that are bigger than us. I believe in consciousness and in things. And I'm just interested in anyone who believes in another realm, sort of, you know, so, and that sentiment by, and if you don't mind, I'm going to pronounce him as a South African would. In Australia, we pronounce his name as Labuschagne, or certainly the test cricketer, Labuschagne, but in South Africa, that name would be pronounced Labuschagne. And that line by Labuschagne that I don't believe in these things. I believe in people who believe in these things. And that's actually what I feel. I'm interested in people who believe in something. I'm less interested in speaking about belief itself, but I'm more interested in what people believe in. And I'm equally interested in people who don't believe as well. So yeah, that's just a little thread there. Mm. Of sort of where I've come from. I don't know if it speaks to the question directly, but it's probably worth mentioning.
I found it extraordinary and just some sort of writing thinking that something I was listening to recently, which I can't recall exactly, but talking about worlds and world building and the way they influence stories. And it really doesn't matter what element you bring into a story, as long as it's internally consistent with that world. So, you know, if you're, I think I might've been listening to something about mysteries and it was like, look, if it turns out the murderer was a dragon, that's absolutely fine. As long as in your story, you've established that dragons are a thing. And in your story, you have a ghost train. And I thought it was extraordinary when Sten talks about it being his train. And actually, in the mythology of ghost trains, people are mistaken. All the trains are his train. And you really kind of got me thinking about, like, how do ghost trains even exist? This idea, you know, like ghosts and the supernatural predate trains by, you know, millennia. And then I suddenly thought, like, this train feels like a story, and stories have existed as long as there have been people to tell them. And suddenly in your world, I had this internal consistency that there's something about this train that's a story, and my own, you know, how I feel about the supernatural, which I don't have a firm feeling about, suddenly made a lot of sense to me, because I believe in stories. And I thought, this wonderful idea that whatever people were seeing was this story that kept carrying on carrying forward, felt really wonderful to me. And I'll end this chapter of Andrew tells you how he read a book, but I just wanted to I just kind of wanted to comment on that, because you throw up this idea of the supernatural, but then much like, I keep coming back to kind of the Tim Burton's original Batman with Michael Keaton, you don't ram it down our throat. Like, I think Batman appeared about 7 minutes in that film, and the ghost train is not driving through the entire story, except in that it's always on people's minds. And I love the way you handle that.
Thank you for sharing that. And, in sort of setting out my stall for the story, something that I really had to sort of grapple with was, how am I going to pitch this? Like, how? So firstly, am I able to suspend a reader's disbelief here? Can this thing exist in a way where my characters can speak quite matter-of-factly about this and us take them seriously? Secondly, is it an ominous sort of presence? Is it of its own mind? What tone did I want to give this? And that, again, was one of those things that really came through the drafting of it. But I really appreciate your comment that for you, it sort of brought this feeling of story. For me, I felt like the train represented sort of that hope that, that things are possible, that impossible things are possible, that all you need is to believe in them, in something, and take it seriously. Or all you need to actually do is take yourself seriously. And these characters, they're all a little bit crazy, but they take themselves very seriously. And I think, like, that's, I think, what sort of reinforces that idea. That if you believe that something can be possible, then the belief that it can be possible is more important than the fact that it has to be.
Mm.
So that's, it's sort of interesting. I think that train can represent many things.
Well, all I would add there is that there is a place the impossible is possible, and that is in stories. And I think about Geo, and what is his passion? What is his dream except the story he is telling himself about this thing that will happen in the future? And it's just, yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, if I want to recommend this book, do I tell people about the incredible relationships? Do I tell them about the ghost train? I really have gotten so much. So, Brendan, look, I want to thank you so much and reintroduce you to people. I am speaking with Brendan Colley. We are discussing his novel. And I'm not going to, it's not your first novel. It's your first published novel. But, yeah. Brendan, it's terrific to have the Signal Line and to be able to share it out there with our listeners.
No, thank you so much, Andrew. And it's wonderful to be able to, have an opportunity and the honor of, like, talking about something that you've written. So I've really appreciated this conversation.
That's it for this great conversation with Brendan Colley. Brendan's new book is The Signal Line. It's out now from Transit Lounge. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel, with special guest appearances by Rocket. If you're a long-time listener, you know my cat. And she decided to headbutt the microphone throughout this recording. So, hey, Rocket. Good to have you here. Stay in touch. You can contact me or Rocket. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just look for Final Draft 2SER. Subscribe in your podcast app to get a new great conversation every week. I am Andrew Popel. I will be back next week, probably with Rocket, and there will be more great conversations from Final Draft. Happy reading. I hope you have a cat in your lap.